Okay.
I'm actually going to change the title just a little bit. What I'm going to be looking at is trying to look at the contradictions of today's capitalism, as opposed to just the, you know, a question of the crisis. Because I think that it sort of follows on from what Abby was saying. If one key part of the Marxist method is knowing that the reality in which we live is one that's riven with contradictions, and knowing how those contradictions can play themselves out is important. I think that's particularly important when looking at the economy. So I'll start by telling a story about one aspect of the 1990s American economic expansion. Because in the 1990s, the U.S. economy experienced its longest ever economic expansion, from the recession that ended in 1991 until the almost recession around 2001, when the stock market crashed around 9/11. It was about 10 years of uninterrupted growth. That is actually a longer period of time the longest period of time of uninterrupted growth that American capitalism has ever experienced. And at one level, it seemed to be creating a lot of wealth. I mean, everyone talked about the American boom in the 1990s under Bill Clinton and all this type of thing. Look at it from the standpoint of American steelworkers. If you worked in the steel industry in the 50s and the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, that was the good job. That was where you made well above the average wage. You made, you know, $25 an hour, $30 an hour, that type of thing in today's terms. You had a pension plan. You had benefits. Healthcare benefits are a huge deal in the United States, where 45 million people do not have access to health insurance. Through the course of the 1990s, so this was, if you were working in the steel industry, in Bethlehem Steel, that was the biggest of the steel companies, you had it made. That was the best job you could get as an American worker, a blue-collar worker. Through the course of the 1990s, for particular reasons, the American steel industry started to go bankrupt. Company after company after company, Bethlehem Steel went bankrupt. And tens of thousands of workers lost their jobs. Now, many of them are now reemployed, but they're reemployed working in the steel industry, but they're reemployed in a particular way. Capitalism does something periodically called restructuring. And if you ever get restructured, look out, because it's usually quite painful. The restructuring took the form of Bethlehem Steel and other big corporations going bankrupt, the workers losing their jobs, the shell of the corporation, the building being purchased by a new corporation, just the building, didn't buy the obligations. What are the obligations? Well, people working for Bethlehem Steel didn't just get a wage, they had a promise of a pension. The people who bought the old bankrupt steel industries bought the shell of the factory without the obligations. What happened to those obligations? $8 billion worth of pension obligations were dumped onto the doorstep of Washington, to the tender mercies of George Bush's administration. There's an institution in Canada and the United States to deal with companies whose pension plans are unfunded and all the rest of it. The workers who were hired back at a lower wage. They were hired back with a much smaller pension plan and with worse health benefits. For the tens of thousands of Bethlehem Steel and other retirees who had worked very hard all their lives in quite awful conditions. Working at a steel mill is not a very pleasant way of making a life, even if you're well paid for it. Their pensions were not gone, but considerably reduced. Cut in half, cut by 70%, cut by 30%. To the extent that now there is a new tradition for retired steel workers in the United States. Get on a bus, travel to Niagara Falls in Ontario, because there's a casino there. It's also pharmacies. You can buy your drugs, which are much cheaper in Canada than the United States. Gamble at the casino and go back to the States. Now, a reporter went up and interviewed and said, "You've been made very poor by this bankruptcy of Bethlehem Steel. Why are you gambling? Don't you know you're wasting your money?" He says, "Well, seems to me that's what my corporation did. Gambled away our pensions, gambled away our wages, gambled away our health benefits. Why shouldn't I try to get my little piece of it back anyway?" It's a tragedy. It's taking a section of what used to be called privileged workers. Some people talk about labor aristocracy, and they've been made very, very, very poor. That story started to come to Canada. It started to come to Canada in 2003, when Canada's biggest steel maker, Stelco, declared bankruptcy. Now, some people said that Stelco's bankruptcy was just a corporate fiction, that they were using the threat of bankruptcy as a way to try to get the same type of concessions from their workforce that had happened in the States. And there's no doubt that they wanted those concessions. They wanted reduced, they wanted to put in less money into the pensions. They wanted to put less money into health care, into health benefits. They wanted to reduce the wages. They wanted to reduce job security. There's no question they wanted to do that. But I don't think the bankruptcy was a fiction. I think that they were really bankrupt. If you look at the statistics from their annual report in 2003, Stelco was losing money hand over fist, almost $500 million in the course of the first full year of bankruptcy losses that they had encountered. Okay, but then a remarkable thing happened. This bankrupt steel corporation in 2004 suddenly started to make money. It was still under bankruptcy protection. At first it was a little bit of money. And then it was more money. And then it was more money. And by 2004, 2005, Stelco, still under bankruptcy protection, was making more money per quarter than it had ever made before in its entire history. It was embarrassing, actually. It was embarrassing to the report on business. It was embarrassing to the Stelco executives. It was because they're here. They are asking the workers, "We're very poor. We're very bankrupt. We're losing money. Please help us out. We want you to take a cut in wages. We can't afford your pensions." Suddenly, they're making money hand over fist. What had changed? This is why I want to talk about contradictions in the world economy, not just crisis. What had changed was the emergence into the world economy of a factor that had not been anticipated by many economists, either the left or the right. So the new factor was China. The new factor was the emergence, and China is a metaphor. It's not just China. There's China and India. China is the lead example of it. But in all of Asia, but I'll focus on China, there is a new industrial revolution going on that had an impact on Stelco. In 2003, China was a net exporter of steel. It was producing steel and exporting it onto the world market. That was one of the factors that was leading to the crisis in Stelco. The price of steel, there was too much steel being produced to too few buyers. The price of steel going down, people can't make it, they couldn't sell their goods. Stelco and other Bethlehem Steel mills go bankrupt. But in 2003, there was a shift happened. 2003, China went from being a net exporter of steel to being an importer of steel because it's undergoing, I'll give some statistics in a minute, like extraordinary industrial revolution. There is a huge, huge expansion of the economy going on in China, and expansions of that type requires a tremendous amount of coal, oil, aluminum, and steel. And the steel that is necessary for China's industrial revolution is creating a huge demand for steel that's going on to this day, that leads to the price of steel going up, that led to a huge market opening up for people like Stelco. Suddenly, the company is making money. The boom is extraordinary. The figure, and it used to be, you know, when you looked at the world economy in the 70s and 80s and 90s, into the early 90s, China and India and places like that were usually dealt with as just a footnote. They were just a footnote. Because they were so poor. And China still remains a very, very, very poor country, certainly by our standards. And even though they were very big countries, I mean, China has a population of about 1.3 billion, India about a billion. They're very big countries, but because the average, most people in China to this day are peasants on the land, their work doesn't factor much into the economy, the world economic figures. They appeared just as a footnote. But that has started to change in a very big way. Between 1970 and 1982, the Chinese, in a 12-year period, the Chinese economy doubled in size. Still no one noticed it, because it's a low level. Between 1982 and 1989, it doubled again. It's a 7-year period of time. People are starting to notice. By 1995, it had doubled again in size. And by 2004, it had doubled again in size. And by that time, by 2004, people were starting to take notice. Suddenly, there's this enormous new presence on the world system that is changing an awful lot of things about the world economy. And we have not seen growth rates like that in a major economy in the world since the 1950s and 1960s. We used to see this type of figure in the 1950s and 1960s in Japan. This is extraordinary. Now, when I was an undergrad, we would talk about the Group of Seven. The Group of Seven economies were the seven biggest economies in the world: United States, Japan, Germany, France, United Kingdom, Italy, and Canada. Little Canada slipped in there as number seven. We were the seventh largest economy in the world. The G7, that was a metaphor for the G7. That was the big economies, the G7. And now we talk about the G8. Russia got added in after the collapse of the Soviet Union. That has its own reasons. We don't need to go into it. You can no longer talk about the G7 or the G8. You can't really talk about them in the same way, because China discovered a little... There was a statistical anomaly in Chinese statistics that was discovered last year. They found out that the economy was $300 billion bigger than they thought it was. Oops, I lost $300 billion. Sorry. Someone get my wallet? Okay, thank you. Okay, and with that, once they figured that into place, China had jumped past Canada, Italy, France, and Britain, and is now officially, or will be officially sometime this year, considered the fourth largest economy in the world. And that growth is continuing apace. Now, if you go to Walmart or any place, you know what's driving this boom. I mean, the television you watch, the DVD players that you buy, the camcorder, all the rest of it, how many things do we buy are made in China? There is an enormous export of manufactured goods coming from the new industries of China that we find in Walmart and places like that as relatively cheap commodities. And a term has now started to be used about China. It's been called the workshop of the world. That was a term that was used about the United States in the 20th century and about Great Britain in the 19th century. And in a certain sense, it has some truth to it. Tracking the growth of this is not simple. As I said, there's all sorts of confusing things about the statistics. You know, I lost $300 billion. Here's another thing that is that can be confusing. If China is the new workshop of the world, and if this new manufacturing giant is producing more and more and more goods all the time, and is growing at the rate I have been talking about, you would think that there would be more and more and more and more manufacturing workers. You look at the statistics, and the number of manufacturing workers in China seems to be going down, from about 95 million 10 years ago to about 85 million today, which doesn't seem to make any sense. But you look a little closer at the statistics, and it breaks down who does what in the Chinese economy. There's a bottom category is basically unknown, workers with no known classification. About 20 years ago, there were about 10 million people in that category. It's been growing and growing and growing and growing like this until today. It's the biggest thing. It's 160 million people in an unknown category. They're unclassifiable. Now, I'm not an expert on this. I'm not going to pretend I know exactly what the classification is, but I have a suspicion. I have a suspicion that what is going on is that in the Chinese economy, the workers that are most easily counted are the ones in the old state-owned enterprises, and the ones that no one really knows what on earth is going on are the ones that have been thrown onto the job market as these state-owned enterprises are closing and sucked into the new enterprises, the new private sector, the new market economy, that I think is the key to the boom. Anyway, we'll find out over time whether that's true or not. In any case, something powerful is going on there that has had an impact in Canada, even down the street from where I live in Hamilton and Stelco. Okay, this has to force us to... This is a way... We're now getting two different aspects of Marxist political economy coming together in a way that is quite unexpected. Here's what I mean by that. Canada, United States, Britain, France, Germany, Japan, what we call the advanced capitalist world, have for a very, very, very long time, certainly through most of the 20th century, been economies that are mature,
people.
What do we mean by that? Most people don't work on the land anymore. Most people are working in cities. Most people work for a wage. Very few peasants. You know, what's the farming population of Canada? 3%, 4% maybe? Very small number of people. They're urban industrialized economies. In urban industrialized economies, Marx worked out an extremely powerful set of analytical tools to describe the laws, if you want, of how they would function. This is what Abby was talking about before, English political economy. He said, look, in a society that's divided between capitalists and workers, driven by competition, driven by the pursuit of profit, certain things begin to happen, and unplanned. Take it for granted that it's unplanned. General Motors does not work out with Ford and Toyota how many cars they're going to produce and what type. They compete with each other for the car market. Marx said two things happen. First, you get periodic crises inevitably of overproduction, because it's not planned. You identify an area, you're a capitalist. We're a group of capitalists. We're competing with each other. You identify an area where you can make money. Building cars, building office towers, fiber optic cables, computers or whatever. In an unplanned and chaotic fashion, investment pours into that area. And at first, great profits are made. But inevitably, because there's no plan, no one's saying, oh, looking ahead, I think there's too many. There's too many people investing in car plants. Please hold back a bit. Inevitably, too much is produced of one thing. Things can't be sold. Prices start to fall. You get what Marx called a crisis of overproduction. I still think it's as accurate a term as you can get. And other economists who aren't Marxists have identified this. John Kenneth Galbraith is a very non-Marxist economist. He's a very smart fellow. And he has identified many cycles of overproduction that have occurred through the history of capitalism. Marx then identified a second thing. He says, in trying to get out of this, in trying to win this battle of competition with periodic crises of overproduction, there is a tendency for capitalists to try to find a way to produce the same thing as your competitor more cheaply. And the basic way that mature capitalisms can do this is by adding machines. You have a smaller number of workers use more and more machines to produce things more cheaply. You look at General Motors in Oshawa. I mean, there has been billions of dollars of investment put into robots and computer technology, etc. So the same workforce, the workforce at General Motors in Oshawa is about the same as it hasn't changed in size for the last 25 years. But twice as many cars are being produced by the same number of workers. Same number of workers, twice as many cars. Why? Because it's more automated, more computerized, more robots, and all the rest of it. But there is a tendency for, you know, if in early capitalism, workers worked with a small number of tools, hammers, etc., and all the rest of it. By late capitalism, one worker is working with a massive quantity of machinery, computers, and all the rest of it. And Marx looked at this and he says, for reasons I'm going to assert this, I'm not going to prove it. We can go on to it in discussion. He says, he looks at it and he says, that's the kiss of death for the capitalist system. Because at the end of the day, if you think of the economy as a whole, the purpose of this is to create profit. What's profit? Profit is new value, new wealth. If you create something new, that's a creative process. In the productive process, what's the creative force? A hammer is not creative by itself. A computer by itself is not creative. An industrial robot is not creative. Only a human being is creative. That's what we are the special commodity. We bring to the work process our capacity to create. When we interact with a computer or a hammer or an industrial robot, we can create new wealth. That's where profits come from. But Marx says, but look, the source of profit is labor. But over time, because of competition, there's a pressure to reduce the amount of labor and increase the amount of machines and automation. Over time, the source of profit is shrinking. You're going to have profitability crises. The rate of profit is going to go down over time. And that was the second part of his anatomy of capitalist crisis. First one, periodic crises of overproduction. Secondly, in the long term, the rate of profits tries to go down, and those crises of overproduction are going to get worse and worse and worse. Okay, how has this played out over time? In the 1930s, the Great Depression, that was almost textbook. That was a textbook example of these factors coming together. Capitalism was able to offset that for a period of time. World War II, through awful means. I mean, there was so much destruction in World War II. it created such a big hole in the world economy for demand that production was able to start up again. But in my lifetime, we have seen a return to periodic crises that have 10 minutes, okay? That have dominated our lives. The first one was in the 73-74. I remember it. I was an undergrad, I guess. It was a shock, a recession that lasted a couple. Some people call it the oil shock. I don't think that's the real reason it happened. Unemployment went to about 8%. It felt very high. The next one, I was working. I was in the working world. It was 79-82. Unemployment in Canada went to 12.5%. That's the period of time where the industrial belt in Detroit and Michigan became a rust belt, with factories closing like mad. That's the background to Michael Moore's films about Flint, Michigan, where the great auto towns become ghost wastelands, ghost towns, people's lives absolutely destroyed. And this is following the pattern. 73-74, 8% unemployment. 79-82, 12.5% unemployment. Very serious recession. It seems to be following a pattern. We talked about this, of each recession worse than the last, deeper and worse than the last. 89-91, there's another slump that hits the world system. It's bad, but it wasn't quite as bad. 11.5%. It's not quite following the pattern. The next round, late 90s, early part of the 21st century, there was a slump, there was a recession in Canada. There's some question whether there's a recession in the United States, actually. And unemployment did not go anywhere near 11.5%, 12%, 8.5%, 9%. Something else was kicking in. Something else was changing. This was an earlier part of Marxist capital coming on stream, because I've talked about one type of crisis. One type of crisis has to do with mature capitalisms, where the key to the system is based upon the relationship of labor to machines. But there's an earlier type of capitalism, which some of the terms are not the happiest terms. Marx called them, in early capitalism, he says that one of the key things is primitive accumulation. And what he's talking about is a system where capitalism is only getting off the ground, where the first thing to do is to create a workforce. The first thing is to pull workers into the workforce. What does that mean? You encounter a society of peasants who are living on the land. You have to separate those peasants from the land and force them into the factories, force them into the mines, force them into the new ways of organizing. Now, that happened in England and Scotland and other places 300 years ago. That was the enclosure movement, the driving the peasants off the land, and all this type of thing. People might have heard about that. That's what's going on today in China, in a big way. In fact, the term enclosures is actually being used by people looking at the situation of the peasantry in China, and it's a huge process. It is right, probably, to call it primitive, because it's absolutely brutal. It's an absolutely brutal process. If you want to talk about the oppression and exploitation of the working population, whether peasant or worker, that's what's going on today in a very big way. The statistics are overwhelming. There are something like 800 million people on the land in China to this day. About 150 million have been absorbed into the urban economy. There's something like 160 million people for whom there is not enough work in the old world economy, and who have yet to be absorbed into the urban economy. It's a huge wave of humanity being ripped off the land and pushed towards the cities, pushed towards the factories, pushed towards the mines and the mills. That's the foundation of the boom in China. And it's affected Canada, it's affected the United States in different ways. And we're just at the beginning of it. This is just the beginning of it in a real way. And it has a different set of laws than what we've been accustomed to looking at in mature capitalisms. Because there's an option in a primitive accumulation economy that doesn't exist in Canada and the United States. You got a problem? Increase the pressure on the peasantry. Pull more peasants in. You got a problem? You're losing some money? Pull people in. People are going on strike? Fire them all. Pull people in off the land. It's a way of disciplining the working class. In a very, very big way. Where did my notes go? There we go. So the implications for Canada are quite... So that that's what I mean by I want to look at the contradictions of the world system. In a certain sense, this presents itself not as a crisis, but as a solution to the crisis. Oh, we seem to have had a crisis in the 70s and the 80s and 90s, but this is a solution to it. China is pulling hundreds of millions of people off the land into the cities, exporting very, very cheap products. I mean, I just bought a DVD, a combined video DVD recorder for $89. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculously cheap. It doesn't matter. What type of a solution? This is a barbaric solution. A friend of mine just came back from China, and what are the conditions of primitive accumulation of pulling people off the land? You could see it on the tramways and on the subways and on the buses in people's lost limbs, lost digits, eyes that are, you know, it's a brutal process where workers have very, very little protection. It's read Charles Dickens' novels about 19th century England. That's the same type of thing that is going on in China to this day. It's a solution that contains within itself its own problems. There are other things that are going to affect the Canadian economy in a real way. I'm not sure I'll have time to get into them all. This is occurring, this rise of China, in a way that we're going to have to. This is going to be the material for our generation to look at and study. It's going to have profound implications for us. Is occurring at the same time as what I would argue is a relative decline of the United States. The story of Canadian capitalism has been tied very, very closely to the United States for all of its period of time. The United States economy is in quite a lot of trouble. Its manufacturing workforce has shrunk by several million over the last 10 years. Now, in terms of thinking through the world economy as a whole and thinking about how this might play itself out, China's rise is intimately connected with America's problems. China is exporting goods to the United States. The United States has to pay for those goods. The United States economy is running massive deficits in government deficits, trade deficits, personal deficits. Who's picking up the tab? China. At this point in time, the Chinese government, sometime this year, the amount of U.S. debt being held by Chinese banks will exceed the $1 trillion mark sometime this year. Now, this is an interesting relationship. This is, I'm producing goods for Doug, but Doug doesn't have any money. So I say, okay, Doug, it doesn't matter. Here's $100. You take $100, now you can pay me for my goods. I export, you give me the money. I want to give you some more goods. Doug says, I don't have any money. So that's okay, I'll give you another $100. Here we go, back and forth. It doesn't quite work that way. That's a bit of a caricature. But that's what's going on. And there's the solution to the world economic system, to world economic problems, the entry of China into the world system, is being sustained by a level of debt that at a certain point, it can't last. It can be $1 trillion. Can it be $2 trillion? Can it be $3 trillion? Can it be four? Can it be five? We don't know. At a certain point, that bubble bursts, and we don't know what will happen in that context. There is a very complex world out there. That's one that we're going to have to study very, very carefully. Now, 2 minutes, 5 minutes. Okay. What does this mean for us? That's a sketch I've tried to do of the world economy, looking inside it at trying to use Marx's method of looking at contradiction, looking at the consequences of unplanned economic growth, seeing the key thing as the relationship of workers to capitalists and all the rest of it. We can see a situation where the tendency towards crisis for the moment has been muted in Canada and the United States, but at the cost of a brutal industrialization going on in a section of what we used to call the third world, carrying with it its own contradictions in the form of building up of massive amounts of debt between the United States and China in particular. We don't know what will happen as a result of all these pressures. We can study them. I can't pretend to know exactly. We do know some things. We do know that the jobs in Canada that are being created as part of this cycle are increasingly low-paying jobs. It's a very, very interesting study. I mean, there's a boom around right now. Unemployment is at record lows. Unemployment is at the lowest it's been for 30 years. fascinating study by a very Marxist institute called the Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce. They're a Marxist think tank. No. But they're very interesting. They say, look, yes, there are jobs out there, but really we're having a restructuring where the things people used to be able to graduate from high school and get a relatively good blue-collar job, now they're graduating from university and getting a very poorly paid service sector job. That's really, there are jobs out there. And I've got three of them. You know, there's a lot of jobs out there, and I've got three of them. That was a joke that George Bush made, actually, once. That was terrible. anyway, it doesn't matter. So there's it's a boom that's built on a huge amount of debt. It's a boom that is built upon the shift from high-paying jobs to low-paying jobs. It's a boom that is being carried on the backs of an ex-peasantry in China being forced into the cauldron, really, of very, very poor conditions in mines, mills, and workplaces in the United States. What do we pull from this? We pull a couple of things. First, in the creation of a new working class that is happening in China, it's not just a new exploited class that's been created. It's a new class of potential struggle. If one of the interesting statistics coming out of China is the massive growth rates that have been associated with this new industrialization, an even more interesting set of statistics is the number of protests by peasants and the protests by workers that have been growing exponentially. Huge number of capitalism creates its own gravedigger. People do not accept exploitation on this level forever without struggling back. We can take tremendous hope in that. Capitalism is creating the biggest working class that the world has ever seen in China. It's also in India. It's also elsewhere in Asia as well. There's another conclusion we can draw from this. The conclusion is, if someone asks the question, what's the future of the world economy? We have to, with all modesty, or I will say, that I don't know. I can outline these contradictions. I can do my best to try to peer into exactly what's going on now. We can't say exactly for sure what will happen. We do know that they're enormous, that these contradictions are unsustainable. It's like the pressure of tectonic plates pushing each other together. How much level of debt can the U.S. economy sustain over time? We don't know. At what point there's a breaking point, but at a certain point there is. But the third thing we should say is that we shouldn't predicate our activist work on what prediction we make about the world economy. There could be a breaking of this cycle in a catastrophic way in a year, or in 5 years, or in 10 years, or in 15 years. We don't know. There could be a sudden crisis in the Chinese expansion that leads to a slowdown in the world economy that's really cataclysmic, but then after a year or two things start up again and the production process starts again. We've seen that on several occasions where a big crisis in the world system leads to huge instability, but then production restarts. We don't know. All we can do is try to study it and look at the pressures on working people, the pressures, and do that, and don't predicate our activity on that. The fourth thing, though, is that in seeing these pressures, it can tell us something about how we can act. We know that the low-paying jobs that have been created in the so-called boom are jobs where conditions need to improve, where we have to organize, where we have to try to make things better in the here and now. We know that if a workers' movement or a peasant movement emerges in China against the exploitation that's happening there, it's a movement that will need solidarity from socialists and activists here. And we know that if we do this work with an eye to the future, that the only way to get out of this, to get a more rational way of organizing the world's economy, is through the types of things we talked about in the first session, where working people and the poor collectively get together and discuss, what do we actually need? What should we actually produce? How should we actually build this? If we know that that's our goal, then that will inform how we organize in the here and now, that we're always looking for ways of encouraging people's self-activity, encouraging people's own form of self-organization, encouraging people to take control of some aspect of their life as they struggle against it. If we do that, that's I think, the lesson that we can take from looking at these pressures in the world economy, and then we can fight in the here and now with an eye to the future. I'll conclude with one example of this. Sometimes it's easy, you know, we know that there was a revolution in 1917 in Russia where for a brief period of time the workers took power. We know that by looking back. In 1916, no one knew that. No one in advance knew this was going to happen, including Lenin. Vladimir Lenin, the Russian Marxist, he was in exile in Switzerland at the time. He sat with a group of students, and he said to them, he was in his, I think he was in his late 40s, early 50s, he says, look, I'm an old man now. My generation will probably not live to see socialism. It'll be up to your generation to deal with the issue of a revolution that's passed my generation by. 6 months later, he's in St. Petersburg in Russia, dealing with workers' councils, revolution, the end of capitalism, and all the rest of it. We don't know. He didn't know in 1916 that was going to happen. We don't know what's going to happen in 2005. But we do know that the key to the future, that capitalism's contradictory development is appalling and barbaric and has to stop. And to the way in which that can stop is through worker self-activity. We organize towards maximizing that self-activity. That's what we can do to help work out the contradictions of the global economy as it exists today. I'm going to stop there.